All right, welcome to the afternoon session. Those who are listening to this, boy, we lost a lot of people, but that's all right. first thing I want to do is Amy mentioned something here, and it's a good point. We've been talking all about the LA Intergroup podcasts, which are at their website, which is oalaig.org. Which is actually simple to remember if you want a thing. It's OA, which is obviously O Readers Anonymous, LA, which is Los Angeles, IG for intergroup, and it's org because it's an organization. And then also over on the other side of the hill, the San Fernando Valley has a podcast too. It is OASF Valley, as in San Fernando Valley, OASFValley.org, and they have things there. I don't know if they have an official. The word podcast, by the way, is, you know, it gets universally meant as something that's up on a website, but LA actually has a podcast, which means you could go to iTunes or one of these things, and if you type in, you can hook in that way. There are actually some third-party apps out there for listening to these, too, so you can get those. So I just thought I'd mention those. Back here we are. Camp Arowana. Am I the only one who noticed that Arowana rhymes with marijuana? And that they probably don't have any NA retreats up here because we're worried about relapse. So I was finishing up on sponsorship, but I didn't want it to keep dragging on. And I was saying that, you know, part of the responsibility, I think, as a sponsor is to be able to gently but honestly tell the truth. That's my job, I think, as a sponsor. And to find a way to do that in a loving way. And I always talk about that I feel that there's got to be a right way to do that. And I talk about sometimes about, I said, my disease sort of loves reinforcing that they're there. And I have a name for that, and I want to make it really clear. This has nothing to do with the gender of the person, but I call it mommy love versus daddy love. And mommy love is that kind of love that you give to young kids. Oh, you're great. You're wonderful. You're the king of the universe. And, you know, you can do no wrong. But at a certain point for a mature, you know, kid, there becomes a point of wanting daddy love, which is, you know how mommy told you you're unique and special and everything. Well, here's the real deal, you know, and there's this great website. I'm not going to mention it because it's an outside website, but they do takeoffs and goofs on all of those. You know those lame corporate posters that companies put up to, quote, motivate you, you know, where they have the fancy picture and then the slogan under it? Well, this is ask me about it later if you want to know the name of it. But they had one up there that like has a picture of a snowflake. And it says, you are unique, like a snowflake. And then underneath it says, like every other snowflake. You know? And that, you know, it's a daddy love. You know, yes, you are unique, but guess what? So everybody, whoops. I'm going to wonder what that sound was. With this mommy daddy love thing, you see, I think mommy love is the kind of thing that sometimes happens where sponsors, when a person's relapsing, oh, don't worry, you know, don't worry, it's okay, don't beat yourself up, just, you know, keep coming back, relapse is part of recovery. And the trouble is, my disease will suck as much of that love as possible. Oh, you mean I shouldn't beat myself up for relapsing? Well, I'll go do it again tomorrow, this way I won't beat myself up. Whereas daddy love is about saying, yeah, you messed up. Let's see if we can figure out what happened there and get it better. You know, the key phrase still is love. It's still about that, you know, because, over my other program, they'll talk about tough love. And what they got a sponsor who's trying to work his anger issues out in his sponsees. But the idea of being my job, I think, is to say if this is a problem, yeah, you sort of messed up. But let's see if we can figure it out. Not to sort of make them feel. There was a part of me when I was younger to, I don't want anybody to feel bad. And I'm not saying anybody should beat themselves up. But, you know, I mean, if somebody in AA goes out and drinks, they're going to feel bad about it. You know, I went and had a I brought a guy because a guy from my men's meeting in AA was interested in OA, so he took him to meeting. And I don't know if anybody's ever like taken somebody to their first meeting and it turns out to be the worst meeting in the world. Well, I happened to take this guy to one where it was like nobody was abstinent and everybody got up. Well, I relapsed last night and this happened. Another person, yeah, I've been binging for a week and all this. And we walked out of the meeting and my AA friend says, you know, John, you know, we slip in AA, but we don't get up and brag about it. And, you know, I think there was a part of me as a sponsor that didn't want anybody to feel bad. It's, oh, don't worry. And a lot of that's changed. I think one of the best things that happened to me is being as a sponsor was going to Al-Anon and really learning I'm here to share experience, strength, and hope. And not, you know, when I was young and didn't have a lot of recovery myself as a sponsor, I would get into like power struggles with people. Now I'm like, hey, you know, you can do what you want. I, you know, one of the things I try to make my sponsees feel okay about telling me anything and promise them I'm not going to judge them. And what I tell them is I said, I do not care what you eat. I will not gain a pound as a result of it, you know, meaning that we each, you know, and to be there and to be honest, I really think one of the most important things is to be as honest with at least one other person about your food and not make this deep, deep, dark secret, you know. I mean, my family of origin, this alcohol, it was a family secret, you know. And I remember my brother one day was said to one of his friends, my mother's just a drunk. And I was mortified that he said that. He told the family secret, you know, and I think back, he was the well-adjusted one. He said, "Hey, that's not my problem," you know. But I, you know, as a child of alcoholics, this nasty thing, and it's also like this nasty thing if we eat, and to have a sponsor who will listen and love, but say, "Okay, let's see what we can do about it." I mean, I think that was a really important thing, you know. You know, because one of the things, and I'll talk about when it's step 6 and 7, is that my disease preys on my immaturity, you know. And again, that mommy love is part of the desire for that is part of that immaturity. So I need a sponsor I can be honest with and you know, be willing to talk about stuff and know he's not going to judge me. And that's important. I'll talk about the action plan a little. We added that a few years ago after God knows how many times of wanting to try and get exercise is one of the tools, right, Margie? Jack Z was one of my favorite guys. He passed away a couple of years ago. God knows he was at every conference, and he came back one day and said, you know, John, they're just not going to be happy until there's 12 tools. And I'm like, yeah, you're right. The other one I always heard from a sponsor is thinking is not one of the tools, which I always love. But, you know, when it talks about action plan a little bit, I mean, it's about, for me, it's about, like, having an emergency plan. Like I mentioned, the old-time AA stuff was, you know, know what you're going to do if the stuff hits the fan. You know, it's really easy to be absent when everything's going well or to steel yourself if you know you're going to go to a family gathering where people push your buttons. It's when, bam, something comes out of the blue. How do I handle that? And to somehow have some plans of what's going to happen if that kind of thing happens, and to have some plans. You know, or, you know, for example, traveling, you know, to know if you're going to travel, you know. The one thing that is a little harder about being a recovering compulsive eater that is trying to work some kind of a food plan is we have to think ahead a little bit more. You know, we don't have the same luxury. I had to go to this business meeting, and it was like a dinner kind of business meeting. It was a networking thing, and they met at this Mexican restaurant, right? Now, they are all there and they're drinking, right? I don't drink well, and they're just sitting there BSing and talking business, and they're you know, it's dinner time, I'm getting hungry, and they're just sitting there chowing down on the tortilla chips and ordering more chips, and nobody's ordering food, you know, and I'm not eating the chips, and finally I'm just like, hey, can we order here? I have to eat something. But in other words, I have to be able to think ahead about that more, because if I have to take care of myself. That was saying to somebody at the break, I have, you know, that the whole idea of put the mask over your own face first. You know, that old thing that they say in the airport. I have to take care of myself or I can't be of any help to anybody else. And so I think that's an important thing. I'll just talk a minute about exercise. Again, we for a long time at the conference were, you know, constantly being bombarded with having exercise as a tool. And I voted against it, even though I'm a huge proponent and talk to all my sponsees about it. But part of it is this. My feeling was, look, there's a lot of wonderful liver cleanse things out there that help people who have damaged their liver as a result of drinking. And AA has never said, let's get involved in that, because they realized our primary purpose is to recover from compulsive eating. A damaged liver is the result of over-drinking, and our weight is the result of overeating, but we're here about the primary purpose of working on the eating. The weight, you have to sort of work on your own. Now, I talk to my sponsees every day. I do exercise. I have this thing, and I'm not going to mention it's a commercial thing. You'll see it on TV. It's sort of like a Stairmaster, but it's got a little extra thing. And I try and do. I do a half hour to 45 minutes on that every day. I actually usually do it at night. And, you know, I do some weights. But that's because here's my feeling on it. I got a gift from God when I got abstinent. I took, you know, forever I was trying to get my food in order. And that means I got given a life back. I got given a body back. And as a result of that, I have to meet God halfway. You know, I got this. I always said, imagine if somebody gives you a brand new car for nothing. The least you can do is put some damn oil in it, right? Well, I got given this life back and this body back. The least I can do is then maintain it as best as I can. And also, I don't know, for me, I you know, again, I was mentioning earlier, I want to be at a healthy body weight. And as I get older, my ability, you know, to eat food goes down. And so maybe a little of that is making up. I always joke. I said my exercise piece of equipment is essentially makes the difference between what my metabolism was at 30 and what it is now. I mean, I'm not using it to be exercise bulimic, but I also know I want to keep healthy, you know. On the other hand, I also have to be careful about overdoing it because I have a compulsive personality. You know, my old slogan is anything worth doing is worth overdoing, right? But I know, especially with exercise, I have to have an upper limit on it too. Because when I was younger, I would like, well, if I did, you know, but I used to run until my legs started to give out. Well, if I run for 20 minutes today, then tomorrow I want to run 25, and then next week I want to run 30, and then next week I want to run 40, and then I'm sitting there going, God, I got to go out and run 40 my minutes. I'm going to take the night off, and the next thing you know, I've stopped exercising because it's become a daunting thing. Instead of being happy, just finding something that'll be good, you know. But that's sort of my compulsive thing. And I said, yeah, again, this is something about exercise bulimia. In other words, and I went through that at one point during my relapse, where I would do 45 minutes on a Stairmaster and run on the treadmill for 45 minutes, and yet I was gaining weight because I'd go home and chow down, you know. And this guy Charles from the Vision for You group had a great line. He says, you know, when it comes to exercise, you can't outrun the fork, which is a great line. And it's true, you know. I could exercise I don't know how much and go out and blow that in 10 minutes of eating, you know, at least eating the right kind, not the right, the wrong kinds of things. So, that, you know, I just mentioned that action plan about the tools. Writing. I don't write as much as I should, and I admit it. I mean, my sponsor, Carmichael's sponsor had me, you know, when I was last time I went through the steps and stuff, he had this thing about making me write longhand. Oh, God, that was the most excruciating. Because my brain just works fast, and I had to sit there and write. And I kept begging him, please let me type, you know, use the computer. No, you're going to. So the trouble is I go to read him my writing, and then I, you know, it was like, and I couldn't read this stuff. But it is important. The time I use writing is if I start having something going on in here and I can't get a hold of it, you know. There's an anxiety sometimes, something, and I cannot figure out what's going on. I will sit down and start to do what I call, you know, it's called free-form writing. There's a non-program book out there that I won't get the name of, but the woman who wrote it, it was, you know, sort of for writers and stuff. It talked about doing these things called morning pages, where you got up every day and you wrote three pages. And it didn't matter what you wrote. You just sat down and started writing. And that's when I've been having problems, I will do that. I will sit down and start to write. And the beginning of the writing will be, this is stupid. I got better things to do. Why the hell am I sitting down doing the writing? I don't know. I got some anxiety. Don't know what it's about. Well, you know, is there anything going on? Did something happen that got you anxious? No, nothing really. Well, that guy said that one thing about me, but I know that didn't bother me. And then I write, oh, if it didn't bother you, why are you writing it down? And then it's like, ah, you know, all of a sudden I'm like pulling on a little thread, and the next thing you know, my sleeve falls off. Because I grew up having stuffing emotions and stuffing things down, and sometimes I'm just not in touch with my emotions. When I was younger, I was so out of touch with my emotions, I would sometimes have to look at the symptom backwards. I was going through something, and I didn't even know I was going through something, but I had just gotten back when the computers were really just getting good in the Mac. I had just gotten a Mac, and I turned around, and after a week or two, I had gotten like 500 fonts for my Mac. And all of a sudden, I go, this is weird. And all of a sudden, I realized something was bothering me, but I had directed all of my compulsive energy into that, and I had to look backwards, because sometimes I just can't access correctly. And that's where, for me, writing became an invaluable tool when there's something, whether it's generalized anxiety or something, to try and pull that little thread out and figure out what the heck it is that's going on. Meetings. I'm going to talk about meetings, and I'm going to get a little opinionated here. You know, this guy Terrell, you may have heard us mention him. Terrell gets up and he's got like 40 years, and he gets up and goes, I have earned the right to be an opinionated old timer. So I slightly am, I admit it. One of the best things that happened to me, well, it was an interesting story. I was in probably my first week in the other program, maybe the second week, and we had a meeting where we went around, and some of the meetings in our area were like discussion meetings where somebody would talk about something as a topic, and then we would all talk on the topic. And it happened to be a meeting where instead of calling on people, you just went around the room, right? Well, it gets to me, and I start talking and talking and talking. This is the days before timers, by the way. And for those of you who don't know, thank God for timers, okay? I can hear anybody for 3 minutes, okay? But I was going on, and I was pontificating. Here I am, like two weeks sober, and I'm giving you my wonderful thoughts. And when I finish, and then at the end of the meeting, I look over, and my sponsor's standing in the doorway, and he's like this, come here. And it was one of those, you know, you're about to get taken to the woodshed. But he said the most important thing that has stuck with me to this day. He said, John, let me explain something about 12-step programs. 12-step meetings are not group therapy. And that, to me, is a really important thing. A lot of meetings in a lot of areas become group therapy. And if you listen to the OA preamble, like the AA preamble, it says we're here to share experience, strength, and hope. And I think it's so important, you know. I mean, you know, I think there's an arc to recovery, okay? When you first come in, isn't like one of the best things that happened when you came to OA? You heard people talking about stuff you thought you were the only one in the world that did. I thought I was the only one who took Wonder Bread and took the crust off and rolled it into a ball, you know? And yet I'll hear people, I'll mention that, and there'll be people laughing who did the same thing. And it's a wonderful feeling to identify, to go, wow, I found my tribe, you know? The trouble is, at some point, that identification and talking about what happened and my problems, it has to move. The arc has to move toward recovery through the steps and through the big book, and not to just spend all of my time talking about myself. And that was like my, I always say it, I was in two different OAs. The one when I was still slipping and sliding, where that was, OA was going to meetings and talking to my friends. And the one I'm in now is the one where I work on the steps. Yeah, I will go to meetings and talk, but it's usually about how something happened and how I've used the steps to move forward. Like some of these big book meetings, you'll read something from the big book, and then people will talk about, yeah, well, you see this section, here's what, how this helped me in my life, you know. And I really think it's an important thing. You know, yeah, it does feel good to sit there and talk about you and your problems, but so did eating a chocolate sundae, right? That felt good. But, you know, to get real recovery, I think you want to move more. You know, it's not like, you know, we were talking at lunch or something about, oh, you know, you get this illusion that OA is this total mecca of everybody's in perfect recovery. No, there's meetings that are, you know, you have people slipping and sliding. And there are people I know who that's the OA has always been this group therapy where they get up and all they do is talk about themselves and they talk about their problems. And I'm not judging them for that. I have no dog in this hunt. If that worked, I'd be there to be the first one to say, keep doing this. But those people who are talking about themselves and their problems are talking about the same problems today that they were talking about 5 years ago. Because, you know the line, nothing changes if nothing changes. And that's where getting in the step helps us change a lot of these things and to, you know, move on. You know, one of the things I used to hear, and the other thing is a lot of these people don't have sponsors. So they want to come unload this stuff, and they don't have a sponsor, so they just come and make the meeting their sponsor. And when I was new, maybe some of the people who have been around a long time, we used to hear this phrase, take your mess to your sponsor and your message to the meeting. You know, meaning, you know, do that. You know, I really believe that. And people will talk about, we want a meeting with nothing but positive pitches, no negative pitches. I can hear the worst thing that's happened in the world to somebody if it ends with the phrase, but I didn't eat over it. Yeah. That is a super positive message. You know, you never think about the fact, I call it group strength. You know, when somebody comes and talks about going through some tough stuff and not eating, I think that reinforces everybody. You know, because you all of a sudden, when something happens to yourself, you go, well, look at Jane. She got diagnosed with cancer and she says, damn it, it's not going to make me go out. You know, when Natalie passed away, who was, I mean, everybody in L.A. can somehow trace themselves to Natalie. She was a wonderful person. She probably died with about 45 years absence. I was speaking at her, a bunch of us got up and spoke. And I said, you know, we give out chips. Most of you give out chips at meetings here, you know, for times and lengths of absence. I said, you know what we need? We need a black chip. We need a black chip that says, you died absent. Because I think that's a thing. I want a black chip someday, you know. I want to be able to say I made it, you know. But the great thing about meetings, I need meetings today to keep coming and keeping it green. I need to hear the things that are going on and to remind me when people talk about going out why I don't want to go out, you know. There's that great line about keep coming to meetings. This way you'll find out what happens to the people who didn't keep coming to meetings, you know. And the other thing is I need to keep it green. Somebody said a line, essentially this lady in L.A. who says, I'm not a slow learner, I'm a quick forgetter, you know. And I need to remember these things. That's one of the great things about meetings, you know. The other thing about coming to meetings, it puts your life, it grounds you out. It puts your life in perspective. You know, if I'm just left to my own devices, every little thing in my life becomes this, oh my God, you have no idea. And then you come to a meeting and you hear other people's problems and you go, wow, you know what? Yeah, I got some problems, but it all of a sudden puts it all in perspective to you, you know? And the other thing, I look around and, they talk about stick with the winners. I see the people who I admire, and I watch what they do. A lot of old-timers don't talk a lot at meetings, you know. They will talk occasionally, but, you know, I was taught by an old sponsor, nobody ever learned anything by talking, you know, which is a great point, you know. The other thing, I'll tell you the other thing I warn sponsees about is take everything you hear at a meeting with a grain of salt. We have the most democratic group in the world. You could be binging in the parking lot, walk in, you're going to get your 3 minutes. And it's the same as somebody who's got, you know, you get the same 3 minutes somebody who's got 40 years abstinence. Because when I was going through my relapse, I would hook in to some wacky thing somebody was saying that was also binging to validate myself, you know, thinking, oh, well, see, that's it. And all we had was two people that were nuts validating each other. So I always tell sponsees, if you hear something weird at a meeting, talk to me about it. Just bounce it off of me, you know, and because it's, you know, I think sometimes it's an important thing. I remember I had two different sponsees. I missed my Saturday morning kitchen sink meeting because I think I was speaking somewhere else. And it happened to be this guy, Terrell. I mentioned Terrell a lot this weekend. I don't know why. But Terrell got up and he spoke, and one of the things he talked about is after 19 years in program, he had given up bread. He with the work of his sponsor, took bread back a little and was able to do it. Both sponsees I dealt with that went to that meeting, The one thing they talked about, oh, you know, Terrell said, he took back bread and was able to eat bread again. And both of them, right? And I go, you know, kitchen sink, you speak for about 35 minutes, and then you take questions for another 15. The only thing either of you guys have talked about was the fact that Terrell talked about how he didn't eat bread, and he ate bread again. And one of them said, well, do you think I can do that someday? And I go, did you hear the first part of that where he said, after 19 years? Come talk to me after 19 years. We'll talk about it. And the fact that you're asking about it now, probably not going to work. The other thing is, I really do believe in sort of sticking with the winners, you know, because I want what they have when one of the things they have is long-term abstinence, you know. We were talking at lunch about, you'll hear a phrase in program, well, there's as many ways to work the program as there are people here. And I go, yeah, up to about 7 to 10 years. And then all of a sudden, if you look at the people with 7, 10 plus years, you'll see that that road gets a lot narrower and they're all doing sort of the same thing. I'm not talking lockstep, but things have gotten narrower. Why? It's Darwinian evolution. That which works is repeated. That which doesn't, isn't. And when you hear some of these wacky things of how people work the program, it sounds a little different than everybody else. I have one question. How long have you been doing that? You know, and maybe it's 4 months, 5 months, maybe a year. Let me know when you get to 5 or 7 years and that sort of thing that I go, I don't know, I couldn't stay abstinent that way, if it's still working, you know. And a lot of times those people are gone after a certain amount of time. And just little things I learned when I first came to my first program, come early, stay late. I also got told, sit in the front. And I remember asking one day, what's that about? He says, you're a newly sober alcoholic and you're very easily distracted. So sit in the front. You know, and to this day, I sort of do that. And, it's amazing. Yeah, OA done not, yeah.
As we get older, we have to sit in the front so we can hear.
Yeah, also because you can hear at a certain age, too. These are things, I can always tell that at our meeting in the morning, there'll be 4 or 5 guys in there, you know, 15, 20 minutes early, and they're all AA crossover people. Everybody else, like 3 minutes of the time, you know, before the meeting, they're there, and even 5 minutes into it, you know. Not saying anything, you can do that if you want. The other really important thing about meetings is to remember what is left reverberating in your ears at the end of the traditions. And that's the phrase, principles before personalities. It is so important. Part of the reason I slipped when I first came into AA, I was going to meetings at this AA clubhouse, and that's all I did was hang out with the same group of people. The trouble is I started to know too much information about them, and one by one I was like not listening. Well, yeah, I hear you. You get up and you say wonderful things, but I know that you're screwing around on your wife with that person over there, or he says something nice and bad to me one day. I'm not going to listen to him. And slowly I was checking everybody off the list that could help me, and I'm the one who drank, you know. I always say keep coming and work in the program and try and listen to everybody with an open mind. Don't shoot the guys in your own foxhole. You know, that's one of the things I say. One of the other lines I love to say is, be nice to your sponsees, because you never know when they're going to become your sponsor. Because people go out and come back, and then it happens. I'll give you another one of those things that's just a pet peeve, and a personal thing that just drives me crazy, and that's the idea. No specific foods can be mentioned at this meeting. Wow, I got a lot of control over somebody that if I mention a Twinkie, it's going to make you eat, right? And God knows, we go to AA meetings, and some of them are absolute love fests of the booze, which I don't agree with either. But let me talk about that, okay? On page 100 in the big book, when it talks about that kind of thing and about that. Assuming we are spiritually fit, we can do all sorts of things that alcohols are not supposed to be able to do. People said we must not go near where liquor is served. We must not have it in our homes. We must shun friends who drink. We must avoid moving pictures where they show drinking scenes. We must not go into bars. Our friends must hide the bottles before we go into their house. We mustn't think or be reminded about alcohol at all. Our experience shows this is not necessarily so. We meet these conditions every day. An alcoholic who cannot meet them still has an alcoholic mind. You know, there is something the matter with his spiritual status. His only chance for sobriety would be to some place like the Greenland ice cap, and even there, an Eskimo might turn up with a bottle of scotch and ruin everything. You know, ask any woman who sent her husband to distant places on the theory that he would escape the alcohol problem. You know, it is our belief any scheme for combating alcoholism which proposes to shield the sick man from temptation is doomed to failure. I think we give in and give the food the power when we say, oh my God, we can't even talk about it. You know, my God, you know, it's the thing that we had. And what if we don't talk about it at the meeting? You get in the car and you look at 15 billboards for Mrs. Fields and you get listen to commercials as soon as you get home. We have to find peace with this substance. And again, I'll get off the soapbox on that one. And I'm a great believer, again, in phone and online meetings and podcasts, meetings between meetings if you need them, especially, let's say you go somewhere where you get on a cruise and you can't even get to a phone meeting, have those podcasts with you, you know? Because this is a disease about isolation. And again, no substitute phone meetings for face-to-face unless you can't make it. We had a friend down there. She broke her leg, could not get out. So phone meetings were there. They were her lifeline. But as soon as she was better, she got back to meetings. And then service. I just want to mention one thing about service. Is when I first came in and I heard everybody talking about service, I was like, oh, you're just looking for some free labor here. You know, that's what I really believed. I was very cynical. And the thing I came to understand is the thing that is true throughout the program. So many of the things they tell us about in program that are helpful for us, we can't see why they're helpful when we go into it. We got to go through the process and turn around and look backwards and see. And when I started doing service, I grumbled and groused, but I was taught to do what my sponsor said so I did it. Then later, I could turn around backwards and realize, oh my God, now I understand what service is about. It's about getting out of myself. It's about doing things for other people and doing them because it's the right thing to do, you know? And to realize that, you know, again, it's about doing that. It starts showing you the benefits of selflessness, you know, and it helps build self-esteem. When I hear people talk about, you know, how do you get self-esteem, it's really simple. You start doing esteemable acts. You know, there's that great reading in program, Just for Today. And one of the lines in that is, just for today, I'll do someone a good turn and not get found out. And what that is about, it's I feel better about myself when I do that kind of thing. And I walk out with a much better feeling than if I go, oh, look at this wonderful thing I did, and get a little, you know, praise for that. And so that's about, anyway, that's about the tools. I want to then get out of the stuff about, you know, getting abstinent and working abstinence into these steps themselves, or, you know, or not that we weren't talking the first three. But to talk about the fourth step, I call it moving out of neutral. I really think there's like this big gap between third and fourth, and it involves getting into it. And I don't know any fear in program more than the people's fear of the fourth step. Oh my God, it's some people build it into this huge thing, and they take forever to start. And of course, the longer you take, the bigger that sucker starts to become. You know, in old days, program, bam, you went through these steps really quick, and there's still groups who do it that way. And I'm a big believer. There were various kinds. I was in that other program where we had 130 questions, you know, to do. I'm not a big fan of that because I felt that way of doing the fourth step, it used the same part of my brain that I used to study for the SATs. And as soon as I was done with the SATs, that sucked, you know, that stuff was gone. There might have been a few questions in there that jogged my memory about things, but for the most part, I'm a big believer in the columns that are, you know, on page 65 in the big book. The other thing, I'm a huge believer in the Nike theory of fourth steps, which is just do it. You know, I always tell sponsees, look, it's not going to be your only fourth step if you're planning on being around here for any amount of time. The other thing I say is read what it says in the step. We're here to do a fearless and thorough moral inventory, not write a Russian novel length biography, you know, and to really look at that and change it, and I then start to go through it. The other really important thing I talk about is there's no such thing as step 4-5. There's no such thing as 8-9, right? There's step 4 and there's step 5. And what I tell sponsees is step 4 is about getting this stuff out for you to look at. Then step 5 is to turn it over. But I also tell them, you cannot do a fourth step with any eye on who you're going to give it to, or you will censor yourself. I have given away a fifth step to a therapist. People give them away to clergymen. If you're sitting there and you're going to want to write an inventory, especially, you know, when you get to the sex part of the inventory, oh my God, I have a sponsor who's a little old booby who, you know, I would embarrass to even use a four-letter word. That's not the person you should be giving your fifth step to. And I tell my sponsees, I will not in any way feel, you know, slighted if you take it to somebody else. But make sure in that fourth step, you do a thorough, fearless and thorough inventory, or it's you know, you're not digging down. This is about, we're wounded, you know, and this is a lady who said my disease got in through my wounds, you know, and that one of the things we're doing is we put down the food, but all that putting down the food did is take a Band-Aid and put it over the wound. Well, no, you don't want to just put a Band-Aid over some kind of wound. You want to take it, you want to clean it out, stitch it up, and then maybe put a Band-Aid on it. And that's what the fourth and fifth step is about. It's about cleaning that wound out, you know. But again, you know, you're never, I guarantee you, if you take 2 years writing a fourth step, as soon as you give it away, the second you finish, you're going, oh, I know what I should have wrote. So I try and give sponsees a limit. I say, I don't want you to get this done by such and such a day, because, you know, this fear of giving it away makes it into a huge thing. And in terms of the big book, again, I like the columns. Some people have wonderful little auxiliary things that help. I'm a huge fan of what Laurie has. I don't know if you guys know Laurie from Winnipeg, Canada. And he has a website. And I realize it's a non-program website, but all that's on it, for the most part, is podcasts of him and copies of these worksheets. And I'm a big fan of it. And I'll give you this website in case you want to write it down. It's really simple. It's OA Big Book, all one word, oabigbook.info, I-N-F-O. And I could go through some of this stuff. I see no reason to reinvent the wheel on something that I just think is terrific, you know. And, you know, a lot of it's sort of almost an extension of these Joe and Charlie things. If you guys are familiar with them, they did some wonderful things. And when it came to this inventory, that last column, that's the one that counts to me, you know, my part in it, looking at what is my part in it, you know. And I joke with sponsees, I said, you know, if you're technically able, do it on a spreadsheet, because there's nothing like when you get that done, sorting on that last column of my part and seeing what of a trends you have, ego, 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 or, you know, things like that. I'm a big fan. And then the other thing is it when you work on this, it is about losing the rationalization and justification of a lot of these things you did. And one of my favorite stories in the big book is right near the end of it. It's been around for a couple of editions now. It's called Freedom from Bondage. And I love, there's a couple of things in there, because I had a lot of resentments, you know, and one of the other things I was taught by my sponsor was when you first start working on the resentments, he said, just start listing people. Don't sit there and go all the way across. You can do that later. Just start thinking of everybody you can think of and just write their name down. Go down that list as far as you can. Then when you can't think of somebody else, then go start going across as to what, you know, things happen. And maybe halfway through you'll think of somebody else. Go write that name down and keep that up. And keep working that way. But, you know, I had a lot of resentments, and you know, Part of that was the rationalization, you know, the rationalization of my things and wanting to minimize my things and maximizing the things that were done to me. And in Freedom from Bondage, it talks about rationalization. My desire to be honest with myself made it necessary for me to realize that my thinking was irrational. You know, it had to be, or I could not have justified my erratic behavior as I did. I'd been benefited from a dictionary definition I found that says, rationalization is giving a socially acceptable reason for socially unacceptable behavior. And socially unacceptable behavior is a form of insanity, you know. I was really great on that, you know. And again, I was I always ended up finding a way to make myself the hero of my own motion picture, you know, and you the one who wasn't. And this is a great line Dr. Paul has in On Acceptance, where he says, I judged myself by my intentions, while the world judged me by my actions, you know. And so true that was. You know, a lot of modern four steps add in the whole thing about my part in it, core character defects. I even know one guy who said his sponsor wanted to write another columnist said, and write down what would a person in recovery have done in that situation as a way to look at it. And you know, the last column is in a lot of ways a link to my sixth and seventh steps, because it does show me what all these character defects are and how to work on them, you know. And about resentments, you know, that was my biggest one. And I, you know, you all, from most of you may have heard the line, resentments is like taking poison and waiting for the other guy to die, you know. I'm the one who walks around with that churning of my stomach all the time. And for me, you know, my sort of lousy, you know, my lousy childhood was the major one I dealt with, you know. And it's, this is where I want to read this section from Freedom from Bondage, because she talks about that exact kind of thing. It's about this one specific resentment. She says, this resentment was against my mother. And this is 551, if anybody wanted to know. This resentment was against my... And the other one was 550. This resentment was against my mother, and it was 25 years old. I had fed it, fanned it, and nurtured it like one might a delicate child. It had become as much a part of me as my breathing. It provided me with excuses for my lack of education, my marital failures, my personal failures, my inadequacy, and of course my alcoholism. And I really thought I had been willing to part with it, and now I know I was reluctant to let it go. One morning, however, I realized I had to get rid of it, for my reprieve was running out, and if I didn't get rid of it, I was going to get drunk, you know. I blame so many things on the past. Oh, my horrible upbringing. And it was. And honestly, objectively was. But you know what? I've been out of the house since I was 17 years old, 18 years old. You know, how long can I hold on and keep blaming all of those things and not start taking responsibility? And that was where immaturity, you know, I could learn a mature person takes responsibility for his or her actions. And I didn't want to do that. And the other thing, I'm going to keep talking about freedom from bondage, is the thing that they teach and they taught, and I think it's a wonderful lesson about how to deal with somebody you have a real resentment over. And the first time I heard that, I rolled my eyes, but the longer I'm in program, the more I realize how true it is. It says, if you have a resentment you want to be free of, if you will pray for that person for or thing you resent, you will be free. You will ask in prayer for everything you want for yourself to be given to them, and you will be free. Ask for their health, their prosperity, their happiness, and you will be free. Even when you don't really want it for them, and your prayers are only words, and you don't mean it, go ahead and do it anyway. Do it every day for 2 weeks, and you will find you have come to mean it and to want it for them, and you'll realize that where you used to feel bitterness and resentment and hatred, you now feel compassion, understanding, and love. And I found I did some of this, and I did some of it absolutely begrudgingly, but I was tired of walking around, and every time I thought of that person, having a knot in my stomach. And I said, I want to be rid of this knot. Because I guarantee you, those people that I have resentments on, they're walking around not thinking anything about me. I'm the one walking around with that in my stomach, and I wanted to be rid of it. fears, all of, doing the fear inventory, working on the resentment and then working on the fear inventory. I mentioned it before, and I'll talk about it in the sixth, seventh step. I think almost all of the stuff comes back to fear, all of these things, I come in and as a guy, I want the macho emotion. The macho emotion is anger, right? I always joke, I say a newly sober guy or abstinent guy has two emotions, angry and about to get angry, But the reality, again, anger is a secondary emotion. Anger is a secondary emotion. It's always on top of something, usually fear or hurt. And for a lot of us guys in particular, we don't want to go down there. We just hold on to the anger. And then the other thing that happens to other people is they're taught to not be angry. And what happens then is it becomes depression. Depression is anger turned inwards, And some people have to work on stripping the depression and to get to the anger, to then get under the anger and look at the hurt and the other things that are there. And looking at them in the light of our new beginning, we've turned it over. And I'll talk more about fear. Sex inventory, I'm going to talk about that tonight mostly, sex, body image, and stuff like that. So we'll hold off on that. In the fifth step, again, I mentioned it, I mentioned that you can do it with anybody. Again, I did one with a shrink, and it was one of the best things I ever did because there's a person who's a professional, and the professional can go down an extra level that a sponsor can't a lot of times. And I remember I was telling him, I don't even remember exactly what it was, and it happened more than once where I would tell him about something and he would, and my reaction to whatever it was that happened, and he would say something like, "Do you see how you still sort of do that?" And he would pull together two so disparate things that I would never have been able to do, and maybe most sponsors wouldn't have been able to do. I'm not trying to make a plug for doing it with a shrink, but I'm just pointing out that it really helped me when I did it that way. And again, it's about the thing that says in the AA 12 and 12, in the fifth, it's the fifth step, I said second step earlier, going it alone in spiritual matters is dangerous. And when I did my first fourth step, I'm a fifth step, I walked out walking on air. I really did. I had spent probably the 10 years before that not being able to look people in the eye. I'd walk down the street, I would look down, or even if I was talking to somebody, I would really have trouble making eye contact. And I can look back and know this because I felt like such a piece of shit in here that if I looked at you, you were going to see it. You were going to see it and have a problem with it. Come on, somebody get that. No, it's okay. But then when I did it, I walked out, there was such a weight lifted off of my shoulders because I knew I was at a new beginning. I wanted to not have any of that crap I just let go of accumulate anymore because it was so heavy on my soul and so heavy on my spirit that I just, again, like I said, and that's another one of those places where in program where you have to have faith. And I'm not talking faith in a higher power, but faith in what they tell you about this process, because you can't a lot of times see it until you're past it and looking backwards. And having done that fifth step, I was able to say, now I see why people pushed me so hard to do a fourth step, because the fourth step got me to the fifth step, and how much better I feel now than I felt, an hour before I did that, The other thing I always say is I hear people say, I finished my fifth step and we burned it. And I'm like, did you get the names you're going to need for your eighth step? Because if you burned it, now you got to go think of it all again. At least make sure you hold on to it. Because part of this process is to do the fourth step and the fifth step, and then work on your character defects and get this list of people you need. Let's see, what are the 3 to 4, 4 to 5? Okay, we'll do some more on this. In the sixth step, again, it's so funny. The sixth and seventh steps are really important, but there's only one paragraph each in the big book, right? And I joke sometimes. I think that's because, they only had about 5 years, 4 or 5 years of sobriety, not even that. And I know at that it took me years to realize how important, and it is today probably the two most important steps for me, are six and seven. And they're really an ongoing, lifelong process of working on this stuff. They're so crucial for recovery because I believe my disease will get back into my life through those character defects. And if I don't work on that, like she was saying in Freedom from Bondage, I will eat again, I will drink again. I got to tell you, I'm not a big fan of the phrase character defects. You know, I think it tends to be a phrase from an earlier time, and you know, the word defect right there, there's a certain pejorative sense in defective. I'm a defect. I look and think of these things, and you know, I think it came from, you know, you remember that this 12-step organization came from a religious background, and there was a certain moral and religious thinking when these 12 steps were, you know, originated. And you know, I think that concept of sin and sinning was a lot of times was there in the early days. And thank God, you know, Bill and people got rid of that. Because if I came in and started hearing about sinning, I think I'd have turned on a dime and left and never gotten that. So maybe in some ways character defect was a compromise from what some of the hardcore people wanted, you know. But I happen to like other phrases. I, for me, when I look at my character defects, they were defense mechanisms. They were defense mechanisms I got from growing up in a dysfunctional household. And you know, we're not crazy. We don't come up with these from nowhere. We don't just invent them. These were things that helped us at one point. And I always joke about the word defensive mechanisms. I say, well, yeah, they were defense, but they've gone over to the offense now. And they're no longer needed. And I got to believe what the program tells me is that if I'm entirely ready to lose those, then the word entirely is the major gotcha one there. They will be replaced. That's where I have to have the faith that they'll replace with different ways of doing life. And so for me, defense mechanisms is one. A slightly lighter version of character defects is character liabilities. And again, these are things that don't help me. You know, when you know, they may feel good, and there may be parts of it that are hard for me to let go of. But I know in the long run they'll be good for me. When I first got sober, I remember going to my sponsor and I said, you know, I got. And this is true. I had one of those funny cable boxes that I had gotten, you know, through like the black market that. You know, just get the basic cable, and this cable box will give you everything that's there. And I remember going to my sponsor and saying, telling him, oh, I got one of these cable boxes. Do you think that this whole 6 and 7 means I'm going to have to get rid of those? And he just looked at me and went, what do you think? And it was like, ah, you know. But and so sometimes some of these things are hard, but, you know, it's about wanting to clean the house out, you know. And there's a lot of, you know, in terms of character defects and doing things different, you know, again, in the old days, they would talk, and a lot of religions and things like that, they'll talk about good and evil. You know, Judaism has this thing, Yetzer Hara and Yetzer HaTov, the good inclination versus the bad inclination. And I think we all got that. I mean, you know, you watch cartoons, but the angel on one shoulder, devil on the other. That's man. That's the human, you know, human nature. That there's always going to be this sort of pull on both sides, you know. And part of what the program says is we've got to work on this. Yes, it's a human condition. But it's a lot of that human condition is not good for us and could push us out the door, and we got to change that. And, you know, the other reason I don't like defects is it sort of flies in the face of what they tell me, that this is a disease, you know. If this is the disease, well, you know, why are these defects? And what I realize is that it has to do with the fact that my disease has symptoms, and this is a lot of what these symptoms are. Yes, symptoms included going in and buying, you know, the huge thing of potato chips and eating them down, but it's also about doing that because I feel lousy about myself because I've got some of these things that I know are wrong and I'm doing them anyway. You know, I just found it, you know, stripping out the moral tone helped me a lot, you know. You know, but these were things that helped me cope at one point. But now that I'm out of that dysfunctional household, I realize, you know, they're no longer good. You know, they're not crazy. These were reactions to craziness, you know. But they no longer serve us, and we got to get rid of them. Terms of defects and fear. I mentioned before, I think fear is at the bottom of most of these character defects, at least I had. I can only talk about my stuff, or in some cases, friends I've had who've talked about their stuff. But I think fear is one of the basis things, you know, and it talks about in the AA 12 and 12, fear of not getting what we want or losing what we had, you know, or have. But under this, for me, one of the things was about the defects in personality was about fear. And number one chief fear for me was fear of not being enough. Not being as good as you. Not being seen as good as you. And so it came out in all these character defects and aberrant behavior. You know, fear of not being good enough. Fear of, oh, there we go. We'll no longer be a meat locker for a while. yay! The people bundled up. I think they're doing it just to sell sweaters that they have over there, you know. If it gets cold enough, people will buy those sweaters. And so, you know, but part of this feeling of not being enough, I had to hide that from you. I had to hide it from the world. And the way it came out was through these different character defects, you know. A myriad of ways of misguided efforts to achieve that, you know. These things, character defects, they work against me. And as it says in the big book, also inhibits my usefulness to God and others, you know. A part of this was, you know, comparing myself to others and to know, to prove to you I wasn't good enough, you know. There's a lady named Chris P. down in Orange County, just south of where I live, who always says the shortest distance to insanity is through comparison, you know, and it really is true. You know, I would always end up comparing. You know, the reality is in life with all human beings, I'm going to compare more favorably to you in one thing, and you'll probably feel could compare favorably to me in another, and with all of us, that kind of thing. But I would always be able, I would look at somebody, you know, I'm funny, I'm intelligent, and maybe at least at some point I wasn't as physically attractive or I wasn't as thin as other people. I would look around a room and I'd find that person I compared unfavorably to and think about him. I wouldn't think, oh, I'm funnier than that person or I'm smarter than that person. I would zone in on that. Why? Because I had this pre-existing belief that I wasn't good enough, and it helped reinforce that, you know. There's a thing called confirmation bias. I don't know if you guys have ever heard of it, but it is doing that kind of thing. And what it does is it reinforces a bad belief. I'll give you an example of that. My mother, I went to visit my mother. She lived in Jacksonville Beach, Florida. And you go along this road called A1A, which is essentially, it's one of those roads where there's strip malls on both sides and all kinds of businesses. And they had traffic lights every damn other block. And they were not cycles. So, you know, it took forever to get a mile or two up the road. Well, one day we're going out driving, and my mother's driving, and we're going along, and I just happened to notice, oh, look at this, man. We've made like three lights in a row. And we went along, and we made four, five, six, seven green lights in a row. And all of a sudden, we look up, and there's a light going yellow. And my mother says, see, I hit all the red lights. We had just gone through six or seven green lights, but she goes, see, I hit the red lights. Why? Because that's her pre-existing belief. And by saying that, she reinforced it. And she had no ability to see or say, wow, look at that. I made six or seven green lights in a row. And that was the kind of thing I would do a lot. I would take pre-existing beliefs, and when I found something that reinforced it, I would say it over. And in particular, things that made me less than, because that's the way I really felt deep down inside. The thing with all of this is if I want this, if I want to get better, I have to take those character defects and be willing, as it says, to be entirely ready to get rid of all of them. You know, as it says in Bill's story, get rid of them root and branch, you know. Why? Because, again, this is how the disease will re-enter my life, and I don't want to play Russian roulette with my recovery, you know. Maybe I can get away with it, but it'll be one, you know, just like in Russian roulette, all I need is one bullet to ruin my afternoon, you know, and I don't want that. And because we don't know which of those character defects might be the one that sends me out, I want to work on all of them. And if we don't, we're going to revert to old patterns, you know. And it says in the big book, when harboring such feelings, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the spirit. The insanity of alcohol returns and we drink again. And with us, to drink is to die. It's page 66 in the big book. But again, working the steps requires faith, a faith that this, that me giving up these things that aren't good for me will be supplanted by things that will give me a better life, an easier life, and you know, a more serene life, and make me a better human being, you know, and a person who feels good about themselves, you know. I needed to trust. Again, it was just like with the fourth and fifth. I had to trust that they told me, if I keep doing these things, I will feel better. You know, it's about faith, but it's about going through and getting a better way of life. It leads us, you know, to be better people and to begin to like ourselves. And a person who likes himself doesn't want to do something that is deliberately self-destructive, like compulsively eating, you know. And that's part of what this is about, you know, to turn around and just think of it in a different way. They're telling us if we do these things, we're going to like ourselves. And then as a result, we're not going to want to go back to the old ways of living, you know. In a lot of ways, some of these things seem like a sacrifice at the time. I can look back and realize, oh, I got to change the way I do that. But I can look back now and again, know it was a no-brainer. Again, more of that thing about program of can't see it going this way, but I can see it going back the other way. And so let me just talk about some of the things in me, and then we'll take a break in about 5-10 minutes. The two biggest ones for me of my character defects were immaturity and narcissism for me. Narcissism, just another way of saying self-centeredness, which is what they talk about in the big book a lot. When it comes to the food, I was like a little kid, and that's where my immaturity comes. You know, I want what I want when I want it, you know. I was telling a sponsee one day, I was paraphrasing the beginning of More About Alcoholism. I was telling him, you know, it is the great desire of every compulsive eater to someday eat like a normal person. And he looked at me and says, we don't know. We don't want to eat like a normal person. We want to eat the way we want to eat, but have none of the bad ramifications, right? And that's exactly true. I think of people I go out that are normies. I'll go out to dinner with them. They'll order up some kind of piece of rich cake. They'll take one forkful and go, oh, that's just too rich, and they'll push it away. Does anybody in this room get that, right? I don't understand the concept of too rich in any definition of the word rich, you know? But that's true. We don't want to eat like normal people, and that's part of the immaturity. I want to be able, you know, I'm coming to OA. I'm doing all this service. I work on podcasts. I do work on the birthday party. I go to conferences. The laws of physiology should stop when I walk through the doors of OA. Well, no, they don't. You know what? I still have to do everything today. That's the one great thing about being around people that are old-timers in L.A., the one thing I see more than anything is they're doing the exact same thing today at 30 years in program that they were doing in their first week in program. Being of service, those kinds of things, you know. And I think it's important. But that was the immaturity, you know. You know, I think my disease will just keep whispering. That salesman can make a sale if I'm immature enough, you know. And you know, I'll give you an example. I was in that other program for a while where they had this very strict food plan. And one of the problems with it is, they promised me, if you do this and you work this food plan, you're going to get down to this normal weight and thin weight. And you know what? Absolutely. They didn't lie to me. I did that. I got down to where I wanted to be. But then once I got down to that weight, I started looking at the food plan and what they were telling me I had to do. And I began to get resentful about it. It became an authority figure. And I've got one of these personalities. It's called an oppositional defiant personality. Meaning, if you tell me when I walk out that door, I got to take a left, I'm going to take a right. I don't care if it's off a cliff. I'm going to go out to the right, right? And so these people were telling me I had to work this food plan. And eventually I got resentful, even though I'd gotten what they told me. And once I got it, the impetus to keep going wasn't there. And, you know, eventually I rebelled and I got back into the food a little. And thing about that is that they would have one of the things they would say is we eat our food plan 3 meals a day, nothing in between except diet soda, sugar-free gum, and I forget what the other one was, right? That was what they did. Well, I come back to OA, and things are different. I always joke. I said, those other like hardcore food programs with the food plans, they're like high school, and OA is like college, right? If you went to high school and you didn't show up for class, mom got a phone call, right? Where's your son? Well, you get to college, you don't go to class. They go, how much are you paying a credit? You don't want to come? Fine, you're an idiot, you know? And that's part of what this program says, and it requires a lot more maturity in a way. We have this old-timer, and I know Amy knows Reverend Ray. Reverend Ray, he's got, I used to joke, Ray's been around programs, since there were only two steps. but no, he's been around forever. And Ray gets up, and Ray says, my absence today is I eat whatever I want, whenever I want, as much as I want, if I'm willing to pay the price. And today I am not willing to pay the price, so I eat three weighed and measured meals, nothing in between except diet soda and sugar-free gum. The exact kind of thing they said to me. But the difference is, Ray is working Ray's food plan, and I was working their food plan, you know? I don't have to eat, and you know, there's that great line, how long do I have to eat that way? You only have to eat that way until you want to eat that way, and then you don't have to eat that way anymore. I want to eat the way I want to today. I don't even say the phrase, I can't eat that, because that kind of thing, just another one of those reinforcing deprivation things. I can eat that stuff all day. I'm a free American. I can go down there, God, you go to Walmart, and it's like, I can buy everything in there and do it. If I'm willing to pay the price, and I don't want to pay that price anymore. And that's part of the maturity my program says I got to get. Because if I still have that immature thing, I'm eventually going to eat again. That's the thing. My disease wants to... That salesman I'm talking about, he wants to hold up a balance sheet. You know, in accounting, they have balances, right? Assets and liabilities, credits and debits. My disease wants to hold up this balance sheet in front of me. But the thing is, one side's whited out. My disease wants to say, oh, you poor thing, you don't get to eat this and this and this and this. You know, the other side's whited out. You never. My disease will never pull out the other side and go, oh, you poor thing, you don't get to be winded walking up three steps. You don't get to wear out your pants here. You don't get to sit at home on a Saturday night with nobody to go out with. You don't, you know, it doesn't want to show me any of those things. And I got to realize that's the things I got to look at. That, and do I want to pay that price today? And I don't. And so that's part of why I think my disease could get back in through that kind of immaturity, if that kind of thinking comes back. In terms of like narcissism and ego and self-centeredness, you know, I was raised by narcissistic parents, you know, and the trouble with that is I, you know, it's really easy to just have to grabbing onto that as well, you know. And I was, you know, again, the child of narcissists. There's a couple of really good books out there that are not program books, and I know Amy knows at least one of them. That's a classic in the thing. But, I got that it's all about me. And the trouble with that is they talk about the bondage self, the whirlpool of self is what I say sometimes, because it just keeps getting worse and worse and worse for me. And it restricts my growth, you know. My ego had convinced me a lot of things that happened to me, I took personally, you know. I would take such things personally. And like I was paranoid a lot. Well, you know, paranoia, at the end of the day, comes from ego, right? That I'm paranoid about all these things you are doing to me. Like, you really care, you know? Yeah. You know? And I got this from my family. You know, over in Al-Anon, ACA, they have a checklist. They have, like, these questions. Are you, you know, have you been affected by alcoholism? And one of them says, do you think people and society are out to get you? And I said, I think my mother actually sat me in a chair and said, people and society in general are out there. I swear, it's true. My mother, we joked one time, you know, because my mother would do the same thing my grandfather did about, oh, the world and all these things, a real negative person. And I joked with her one day. I said, you know, if we ever make up a family crest, the family logo should say, the bastards. Because my mother, the bastards do this and the bastards do that. And so how can I not grow up in an abnormal, aberrant way when I have that kind of thing, you know, and that belief, that paranoia thing. And one of the greatest quotes I heard about that kind of thing is it said, the thing that would bother me most about what people think about me is how little people actually think about me, you know. And it really is true, you know. That was part of that paranoia. And the other thing, You know, again, I would take these things personally, and my therapist said one day, never attribute to maliciousness what can be better attributed to cluelessness. You know, when that guy cuts me in traffic, you know, I used to get all harumphy, you know, and part of that was my ego. How dare he? He's clueless. He's driving along. He's probably on his cell phone, and he's paying no attention. And I just happen to get caught up in that kind of thing. But I would take it on, and I would amplify it because it's about me. And, you know, part of that ego thing was me puffing myself up because deep down I didn't think I was good enough. So if I puff myself up and I try and come across, then I feel a little better. Like maybe I'm hiding how shitty I actually feel about myself. And that was part of those character defects that all drilled back down into fear. You know, I remember I would, you know, and it talks about in the big book, I wanted my way all the time, you know, a perfect example of what they say on page 62 in the big book, self will run riot, you know. Today, I've changed that a little. I do think about people more than myself. Over in that other in Al-Anon, there's a small piece of literature, and within it is this thing that says, it's called a checklist for our emotional maturity. And I'm not going to read the whole thing. I don't have the whole thing here. But one of the lines that hit me was, it says, a mature person accepts reasonable delays without impatience, realizing some adjustment for the convenience of others is necessary. That was like, wow. That, you know, in other words, if I want green lights, I got to accept other people sometimes get green lights, which means I get a red one. And that's part of living in society. But there was part of me, having grown up in that narcissistic background, that, well, no, everything's supposed to go my way all the time. And I'm supposed to get everything, you know. And that's, again, that's that maturity, you know. I didn't get it from my parents. You know, part of my problem is, you know, people talk about parenting skills. And my parents not only did not have good parenting skills, they didn't have good adulting skills, you know. They couldn't teach me how to be a good adult because they were both emotionally about 13 years old. My father would go to fix something, and if he couldn't fix it in like 10 seconds, stuff would start flying across the room, you know, because he would just get frustrated. So how can I mean, it's like I used to be a pretty good tennis player, and I learned and I took lessons. But, you know, if you only take lessons from a shitty tennis player, you're never going to get better than a shitty tennis player, right? You need to get people who are better than you so that you can step up your game. And the trouble is my parents didn't have that, so I could never get any more than what I was. And I was really not that much of an adult. The other thing I'll say is the other thing I did a lot was playing the victim. Oh, poor me. Oh, I do all these things for the world. And again, this is about trying to make myself better, feel better, because deep down I really don't think I'm that good. I would also accentuate, again, part of that confirmation bias, I'd accentuate every bad thing that happened to me and gloss over all the good things. And, you know, the longer I'm around, the more I realize, you know, I got bad things. Everybody has bad things and good things happen to them all the time. You know that great line about if you had to take all of your problems, write them down, and throw them into a pile with everybody else's, you'd take your own back because you find out about how everybody has just as many problems. The other thing, and we'll break it right now. The other thing I heard somebody say once is be careful about praying for what you deserve because you might actually get what you deserve. So why don't we take a break for a little while? Come back. If there's any Ask a Basket questions, we'll do that. And then maybe we'll do some sharing. So 15-minute break? Okay.